It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Saturday, September 10th, 2022. I'm Ryan Schmelz. It's the end of a 70-year era as Queen Elizabeth II passes away at the age of 96. As the world remembers the United Kingdom's longest-serving monarch, what is her legacy? And what does the changing of the guard mean for the U.S. as our closest ally welcomes its new prime minister?
She was basically the leader of the free world for 70 years. And, we owe her, I think, an immense debt of gratitude.
I'm Jared Halpern. Congress is again trying to beat the clock before the sprint to Election Day.
Shaking hands with people and all that, there is no substitute for that campaigning just days before an election.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
Seventy years and 214 days. That's the length of Queen Elizabeth II's reign. It's the longest of any British monarch and the second longest reign of any monarch of sovereign states ever recorded in history. As the world grieves her death, people are also reflecting on her life, legacy, and the future of the UK.
I have to say that the Queen was a hugely impressive figure and a figure of, I think, tremendous warmth, kindness, compassion.
Niall Gardner is the director of the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom at the Heritage Foundation and served as an aide to former UK Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. He shares with us how he thinks the Queen should be remembered and what's next for his home country.
She was somebody who really embodied, I think, the greatness of the British nation, the greatness of the British people. She was basically the leader of the free world for 70 years. We owe her, I think, an immense debt of gratitude. I did work, of course, for Lady Thatcher in her private office. Lady Thatcher, when she was Prime Minister, had a very close working relationship with the Queen. And despite what one may, see from, The Crown on Netflix, Margaret Thatcher and the Queen actually got on very, very well. They had a very, very strong partnership. They worked very closely together. And at the time in the 1980s, they were the two most powerful women in the world. Lady Thatcher, whom I worked for at a later stage, had great admiration for the Queen and for the institution of the monarchy. The Queen, I think, greatly respected the fact that Margaret Thatcher was the first woman prime minister and that she was a politician of tremendous conviction, resolve, and principle. And I think she very much respected that and admired it. Prince Philip, the husband of the Queen, hugely admired Margaret Thatcher. I think there was a far closer partnership between Lady Thatcher and the Queen than one might gain from watching Hollywood-style depictions from the likes of The Crown, for example.
And what do you think the biggest thing those Hollywood depictions get wrong about their relationship?
Well, they basically portray a lot of tension, political tensions, disagreements over policy matters. They also suggest that there was a huge sort of class difference between Margaret Thatcher, who came from a more humble background, and the upper class background of the royal family. So, they try to portray all these sorts of tensions and so on, which I think simply did not exist. Yes, there were some policy views that Lady Thatcher had that maybe the Queen did not fully support in every respect. But the reality is the Queen was not a political figure. She did not intervene politically. She played no role in day-to-day politics. But she actively, of course, engaged with the 14 prime ministers during her reign. Liz Truss is actually the 15th. The Queen took a very close interest in British political leadership, but she never actually weighed in on political matters. She did not see it as her role to intervene in politics in any way. And that is right, because you want to maintain the neutrality of the monarchy. The monarchy should not be involved in party politics in any way. It's not a political institution. And so there's a separation of powers between between the monarchy and the British elected government.
And you mentioned her reign. We're talking about 70 years here. So the majority of the population in the UK has lived their entire life with Queen Elizabeth as their monarch. You know, what has it been like for you watching the reaction in your home country and the world, and seeing people flood the streets, give out tributes, and just and their reaction to her passing?
There's just been this huge outpouring of grief, I think, and sadness. But at the same time, I think the British people, they cherish the memory of the Queen, and so they celebrate her life as well as mourning her. She, as you pointed out, the vast majority of Britons have only known a life under the reign of the Queen. And the fact is, now we have a new king, King Charles III, and this is a new era. It's the end of the second Elizabethan era, and the royal family, the British monarchy, begins a new chapter. And you know, the British people, of course, I think, have high hopes for the new king. And clearly, as we saw from Prince Charles's walkabout in front of Buckingham Palace this morning, you know, King Charles, I should say now, I think he will be a popular king. It may be difficult to achieve the same levels of popularity that the Queen achieved, but I do think the British people will warm to the new king. And I think that King Charles also inherits a monarchy that is in a very strong position, because the Queen left it in such a strong position, and the Queen was so hugely loved by the British people, but also across the world. In the United States, the Queen is just massively popular, actually. And I think King Charles will want to, you know, further that legacy in every way possible. And I think he's off to a very good start with his walk about in front of Buckingham Palace, meeting with hundreds of members of the public, shaking their hands. And it's very good to see the king so, you know, in a way so relaxed and so at ease in meeting with the general public, because he's going to be doing a lot of this. And of course, he has a lot of experience of doing so. But he has huge shoes to fill, metaphorically, in terms of continuing the legacy of Queen Elizabeth II.
And you've kind of touched on these next two questions here. But, you know, before we get into King Charles, what do you think the Queen's legacy is?
The Queen's legacy, I think, is an incredibly strong monarchy. It's a monarchy that has an approval rating in the UK of 70-80%, which is very important to have that public support there. In fact, I would say the monarchy right now is stronger than it has been at any stage in many, many decades. And that's a testament to the Queen's leadership. And the Queen really, her spirit of service, dedication, has built up this tremendous loyalty among the British people to the House of Windsor in its modern form. You know, if you go back 40, 50, 60 years, many were predicting the end of the monarchy. You had the end of the British Empire, the 1950s and 1960s, when the Queen came to power. 1952, Winston Churchill was the Prime Minister. And 70 years on, the monarchy is actually just as strong today as it was when the Queen ascended to the throne in 52. So that's a testament to her leadership, actually, because in this modern era, so many royal families in Europe have declined and have fallen. The British monarchy is just as strong, and you know, it may be even stronger, actually, 50 years from now. We simply cannot predict the future, but I think the monarchy is in very good hands with King Charles, and then when he is succeeded by Prince William, who is a very, very well-loved prince, I think that begins another new era and chapter for the royal family, and I think Prince William's family is such a shining example of the greatness of Britain and the traditions of the monarchy. And I think Prince William will be just such an outstanding king and such a popular king as well. So I think the future of the monarchy is secure.
Now, when you talk about Prince William, he will have to succeed the longest reigning or the longest serving heir apparent after he takes over for the longest serving monarch. What can we expect from King Charles?
King Charles, I think, you know, his overall approach may be a bit different from the Queen. He's a very, of course, very low key figure, Prince Charles. But also, having said that, he has been somebody who has intervened from time to time on political matters, despite having a personality that I would describe as quite low key. But he has weighed in on some political matters, environmental issues, immigration, for example, and he's actually been strongly condemned in the past for doing so by especially Conservative MPs who have not been happy with what he's said. And his recent intervention, for example, on immigration issues was very poorly received by members of the Conservative Party. King Charles has pledged not to intervene on political matters as king. And I expect he will hold to that promise, because if you have a king who intervenes politically, that fundamentally changes the nature of the monarchy and will significantly undermine, I think, public trust in the monarchy if that happens. So I think the king will not be intervening on political matters. He should not do so. But Charles's style and demeanor and everything is very different to that of the Queen. And he has also been somebody who has been greatly overshadowed, of course, by his mother for so many decades. Now he is in the lead position, huge weight on his shoulders, immense weight on his shoulders as the new king. But I think Charles will do well as the new monarch and the new sovereign. And he's also, I think, a very, you know, at the end of the day, a very likable person. And also a man, I think, of a lot of humility as well, it has to be said.
But when it comes to Charles, and you just mentioned the criticism he's received from the Conservative Party, well, the Conservative Party has a new PM taking over, and that's Liz Truss. Yeah. You know, what do you think their relationship can be like? And obviously, you've been very optimistic about her taking over here. What can we expect from her?
Yeah, so I think that the new prime minister is going to have a very constructive, close working relationship with the king. Liz Truss is somebody who I think, as a former foreign secretary, as a former trade secretary, with a lot of political experience, you know, she will know how to work with the royal family very closely. She will be somebody who I think will be greatly respected as well by the royal family and by our new king. So I think it's going to be a very productive, close, constructive working relationship. I think Liz Truss is the right person to lead Great Britain right now. She's a very strong, robust politician. She has a lot of political experience. She's a Thatcherite. She believes in the ideas and principles of Margaret Thatcher. I think that's what we need right now, as Britain faces immense economic challenges and a big energy crisis.
And so with the new prime minister coming in, as well as a new king, what does this changing of the guard mean, you think, for the United States?
I think that for the United States, the special relationship is going to continue to be very, very strong. I think the American people will warm to the new king. No doubt he will make a royal visit to the United States at some stage early in his reign. I do think King Charles is going to be popular with Americans, perhaps not quite at the same heights achieved by his mother, the Queen Elizabeth II, but I do think Prince Charles, King Charles, will endear himself to the American people swiftly. In terms of the political situation with Liz Truss and Joe Biden, I have to say there are some tensions behind the scenes between London and Washington over a number of issues, mainly Brexit-related and dealing with the Northern Ireland Protocol issue, which is a big priority for the British government. And I think that Liz Truss is likely to be very assertive in her dealings with the US president. I think she's going to stand up for the British national interest. Joe Biden, I have to say, has not been very helpful in terms of US-UK relations with his frequent lectures towards the UK over the Northern Ireland issue, which hasn't been helpful at all. So I think Liz Truss is going to stand up to Joe Biden where needed, and she will basically tell him to mind his own business when it comes to British issues, actually. And so I think she's going to be a lot tougher than Boris Johnson has been, who's been quite soft, actually, in his dealings with the Biden administration.
But do you think they can have a working relationship that benefits both sides?
Oh, yes. Absolutely, because the special relationship is bigger than any single prime minister or president, and I'm sure that Liz Truss is going to develop a strong working relationship with the president. She will disagree with him on some important matters, and there will be tensions there, undoubtedly, on Brexit-related issues. But my advice to the to the U.S. president would be to work constructively with the new British government and not to pick fights with the U.K. because that is the last thing we need is a U.S. president who is fighting with a British prime minister. So I do hope that Joe Biden will have a constructive, productive, pragmatic relationship with Liz Truss, but there will be significant ideological differences there.
And so for the last question I have for you is, so much of the world is seeing this for the first time. They're seeing the spotlight put on the UK and they're learning a lot about the UK from this. But, this is new for a lot of us, and for a lot of people, they don't really understand this. What do you think people in other countries need to know about this? And how do you explain it to somebody who might not understand, why there's a reaction so strong like this to the death of a monarch?
Yeah, I think that the British monarchy is unique, of course. It's the most powerful monarchy in the world. It has been for many centuries. There's no royal family like the British royal family. And in fact, every other royal family in the world simply does not have the significance and the power of the British monarchy in terms of not only power within the United Kingdom, but also global significance as well. And what happens with the royal family is followed all over the world. Large numbers of Americans, of course, have been tuning into their TVs to watch the news of the passing away of the Queen. So there's this tremendous interest in the royal family across the world, fascination with the royal family, but there's no royal family that has the global significance and reach of the British royal family. And so with the passing of the Queen, the Queen was such a hugely important figure in the hearts of the British people, and so deeply loved, I think, by the vast majority of the British population. And she has been just a part of the everyday lives of the British people. And so with the passing of the Queen, it's an immensely sad moment. It's the end of an era. And I think most British people simply cannot imagine a world without the Queen there. I can't imagine myself a world without the Queen, frankly. But life continues for the British nation. It's the new era with King Charles. We wish him all the very best. We will always cherish and remember forever the leadership of Queen Elizabeth II. She is imprinted upon our hearts, and that will never go away.
Niall Gardner, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
The Will Cain Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox & Friends weekend host Will Cain as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
Congress is on the clock, as is usually the case after the August recess. By the end of the month, lawmakers must extend government funding, likely through a short-term spending bill, a CR, or deal with a pre-election day government shutdown. In an election year, nothing comes easy, especially when you talk about spending levels, taxes, policy proposals, and the unknowns that can upend delicate negotiations. Add to that funding requests for Ukraine and COVID, plus a same-sex marriage debate that could get wrapped into a must-pass piece of legislation. My colleague covering Capitol Hill, Fox News congressional correspondent Chet Pergram, tees up the debates ahead.
And what's interesting about this is that it's just not the fact that they would do it. It's what else might be in this bill. That's key. The other factor is how long they would do the bill for. Now, you might say, well, why is that important? They're probably not going to work out all of the fiscal bills for this fiscal year, going into, starting fiscal year 2022, which starts October 1st. We expect them to do an interim spending bill just to keep the lights on. Do they do it for a few days because they think a broader bill is within reach? That's not out of the question. Or if they have to really punt, and this is usually the rhythm we see on Capitol Hill here, do they go until late November, early December? Or do they propel this all the way over to the new Congress, say, February or March? Well, think about this. The House is definitely in play. There is a very high probability that the House will flip, even with a smaller Republican majority. Mm-hmm. The Senate is anybody's guess. That is a pure jump ball right now. So if Democrats say, okay, we're probably not going to be in control of at least one of the two houses of Congress, we need to make sure that our spending priorities are reflected for as long as possible.
Right.
Now, you might remember last year, you know, Democrats had the House, the Senate, and the White House. They did not pass what turned out to be the spending package for fiscal year 2021 until March of this past year, so 6 months after the deadline. And so you were running the government still on Trump-era bills. These were Trump-era spending priorities. So if you have the Senate, the House, and the White House, you want to affect your policy priorities. So Democrats, you know, they got a late start on this. No, you know, some of the fault was their own, frankly, among other things.
Yes.
But so this is why this could go longer into next year if that's what they want, and if they can get the votes for that, because then they can continue to, you know, spend Democratic dollars in the way they think it should be spent rather than Republican dollars, maybe, which they would agree to, you know, at the very end of the year if they did a shorter bill.
The flip side of that, though, is that Republicans may say, listen, we're going to support something very short, because if we win back control of Congress, the House, maybe even the Senate, we'll have an awful lot more influence on spending levels. So there's not a lot of incentive here for Republicans to agree to some long-term spending bill right now, is there?
It depends on what both sides get. There are certain things that Republicans are going to want in this. Maybe if that is the A1 ask of Republicans, a shorter spending bill, and Democrats say, great, then you have to take same-sex marriage in the bill.
Right.
Yeah, this is the horse trading that's going on here. And so it just depends which side says this is what we have to have. And we don't know that yet.
You mentioned same-sex marriage. I want to talk about that because that is an interesting component that we generally don't think about it in the context of a spending bill. So I want to get to that. But first, let's talk about what the administration wants. The administration has long sought additional funding for the pandemic. That has been stalled. Republicans mostly have said, listen, it's time to move beyond this. The type of funding that was needed at the early days of the pandemic is not needed now. You have the administration who has said, listen, we've had to stop free testing. There are other components to our response plan that are going unfunded. There is now a new rollout of booster shots that are supposed to be sort of annual. That's going to take money if they continue to be free for Americans. Is there any chance that additional COVID dollars gets into a short-term bill?
Again, this is going to be part of the negotiation. Look at this. You know, Republicans balked at doing a unilateral bill for some COVID money, about $10 billion back in the spring. Democrats, because of problems
and
on their
way,
own.
By the way, $10 billion was a lot less than that was what the. Was,
$21 billion.
Yeah,
yes.
That's what the White House wanted. Yeah, the White House wanted $21
right.
billion. Democrats in Congress sort of came down to $10 billion.
Right. And Senator Patrick Leahy from Vermont, the chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, he has indicated and released a bill at the end of July, $21 billion. And some of this would just not deal with American needs. We're talking about vaccines and therapeutics and tests and so on. But this would also, you know, account for some global stuff because, you know, just because you put out the fire here or limited the fire here with COVID, if you're not addressing it overseas, you got a real problem. Look at where all these variants have come from. You know, that's
right.
that's one of the main issues. Now,
start here.
That said, you know, Republicans have said, and I interviewed Tom Cole, who is a Republican from Oklahoma. He is the ranking Republican on the Labor Health Appropriations Subcommittee. And he said, we are going to insist, and this is one of the things that we do know, that the money be spent. We don't oppose spending the money, but it's not new money. It is reprogrammed unused coronavirus dollars. So is that the main ask? They say, okay, great. We will take $21 billion and we will have it offset because we'll take money from someplace else in
because
these COVID
say,
coffers.
Yeah.
And Democrats then say, great, we'll fund the government till March. Yeah. You know, again, that's the horse trading that's going to go on.
Republicans have said, listen, we've spent, I think it's close to $1 trillion. In pandemic response, that money has not all gone out the door. Some of it doesn't need to go out the way it was initially designed to go out.
Right. Right.
And
exactly.
The other question is we expect the White House to put forward another request for Ukraine assistance. Now, Chad, that has been pretty bipartisan up to this point. Is that appetite waning?
It's hard to say because, you know, we're not in those, you know, early days of the war where you had Volodymyr Zelensky beaming in to speak, you know, to all but a joint session of Congress, frankly, joint meeting of Congress. That was significant back in March, right after the war started. You've had an awful lot of lawmakers kind of go, it was a big deal when initially members were showing up. Just how safe was it? Nancy Pelosi went. Mm-hmm. There were some other Republicans at one point who went to the border and tried to get in. There was Steve Daines, Republican from Montana, who went in, along with Victoria Sparks, who, of course, is a native of Ukraine. But now you've had people showing up all the time. And even Liz Truss, the new British prime minister, has said that, she intends to go at some point. So this is like a thing to do now, to Ukraine.
So it's harder to sell like the need then if you're a lawmaker in the U.S. and you're looking at inflation, you're looking at gas prices, is it harder to say, listen, we need to continue to spend billions of dollars at a time to keep the weapons flowing to the Ukrainian military?
And what is very concerning, if you are somebody who is an advocate for Ukraine here, and I would put Mitch McConnell, the minority mm-hmm. leader in that camp, is that you start to have these very conservative right-wing members who say, why are we helping Ukraine? Mm-hmm. You have some who are even more on a conspiratorial viewpoint, who say, that this is something that, maybe we should give more deference to Russia in all this, and that, some of this has all been cooked up and Ukraine is crooked and it's somehow tied back to Hunter Biden. There's that whole narrative that exists in American politics right now.
Well, and you've got some progressives, too, who are growing mm-hmm. uncomfortable with the funding, aren't you?
Naturally. And because
that's always what's funny about foreign policy. I've always joked that foreign policy, generally the right and the left on foreign policy are so close to each other that if they turn around, they can shake hands. That's sometimes how these debates play out.
Right. And the idea is that, it stops at the water's edge here, right. But that's not the case anymore. So the more money they can get, sooner. And this is where Mitch McConnell and maybe to some degree Kevin McCarthy and some others say, we realize that the Senate may flip. And we might have control, which is what they want, of course. The House might flip. But that's going to be real hard to move that money next Congress. So maybe it's easier to move it now. And maybe that's another reason why they would want to punt, deeper into, say, February or March, which is counterintuitive. There's a lot of multi-level chess going on here right now.
Let's finish with what you brought up, same-sex marriage, because the House, before the August recess, passed a bill that would essentially codify the Obergefell decision. Obviously, in the aftermath of the Dobbs case that overturned Roe v. Wade, you have Democrats who have said we need to shore up these Supreme Court precedents in law so they can't be overturned. So they have passed in the House this bill that would allow at the federal level same-sex marriage. The Senate has been sort of taking this up delicately, right? There's been a lot of conversations over the recess about whether or not they can find 10 Republican supporters for this. It sounded like before the recess, Chad, they were pretty close to that number.
And Republican Senator from North Carolina, Tom Tillis, has indicated that they thought they might be able to do that. Tammy Baldwin, a Democrat mm-hmm. from Wisconsin, has kind of been leading this effort here so far. So that's important, to try to get that across. But can they get those 10? Now, that said, it's an election year. If you have, Republicans who are unwilling to go there, that's a problem. Susan Collins of Maine, Republican, who has been a supporter of this effort, has indicated that they would view it as a failure if they didn't do it. Maybe, again, part of these negotiations is say they put this in, the spending bill, because that's how they get 60 votes, because you're not going to shut down the government over that necessarily. I mean, some might, but, that generally is not thought.
It also takes it off the table. I mean, there's some Republicans who have sort of indicated that it might be best to have this off the table.
Yes, exactly. And this is because, Republicans are getting blowback by some of the things that were said by some of the conservative justices, mm-hmm. In particular Clarence Thomas, right. That maybe they should revisit things like same-sex marriage, decision, from Ohio from a few years ago. That's very important because Republicans realize that there is a vulnerability on that issue. They do get a lot of political capital, and people can judge the morality of this sure. going around and making fun of people in bathrooms and what the schools are doing. There's been a lot of that.
The politics on just same-sex
yes.
marriage alone
yes.
have changed
exactly.
so much over just the last 10 years, Chad.
Right. And the other thing, though, too, is just the fact that this was on the table shows two things as well, Jared. Did it change that quickly? I remember, it was in 2004. when Karl Rove was special assistant to the president, and he made sure that in all of the swing states for President George W. Bush, that they got on the ballot in Ohio and other places an issue barring gay marriage. And so that got people to the polls.
It was a turnout thing. It was,
let's energize
the conservative base.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So people think that...
But hear me out here for a second.
Yes, but that's what people thought, that it went that way for a while, and that, that, you know, things changed overnight. There are people in political science now who have started to look at this and say, did we misjudge where the public was? Did they misread it? Because it's, as you know, it's rare for things that, you know, kind of radioactive to change that quickly. So did it truly change that quickly? That's unclear. You know, or did some people just kind of hold their, you know, tongue for a long time? I don't know. But you're right that Republicans' sense of vulnerability on this issue, because they say, okay, it's one thing for the court to have ruled on abortion. You know, that's not working out politically great for Republicans right now. This is why you've seen, you know, registration among, you know, pro-choice voters in Pennsylvania and Kansas go through the sky, frankly. So if you hit them on this, then that becomes another issue. And it also means that Republicans are not talking about what if they're talking about same-sex marriage and Democrats are able to light them up on this. Mm-hmm. They're not talking about the economy and inflation and gas prices. And that's a problem for the GOP.
Just procedurally, the reason that they would add this to the CR and not do it standalone is just a matter of time. A standalone bill in the Senate.
It could be because it takes about 2 weeks. Yeah, it takes about 2 weeks to get something through. But remember, the Senate, at least schedule wise, is supposed to be in through, you know, about the 20th, 21st of October.
We'll
you know,
see.
And you know, and I have seen this work a myriad of different ways over the years, Jared, about. They're in session right up to the election. I've seen them get out of Dodge in late September, you know, and that's it. Call it a year, frankly. And nobody has really demonstrated to me ever. And I asked somebody learned about this a few days ago. I said, is there any empirical evidence that when they get out early and people go back home and they campaign, does it help one party or the other? And There's no real, you know, literature on this, frankly. I will say, though, that most politicians will tell you that there is no substitute for going home in person, going to luncheons and town meetings and rotary clubs and fairs and shaking hands with people and all that. There is no substitute for that campaigning just days before an election.
And we will obviously have a lot to talk about as that election is really close now, about less than 2 months away, Chad. So a lot on the table for Congress between now and then. It's nice to have them back. I hope you enjoyed your August recess, and now we all get back to work.
What August recess? We were here for a while, weren't we? and we had one of the biggest stories, the Mar-a-Lago story, every year. Yes.
You warned me. All right, Chad. We'll talk soon.
Tomorrow on the Fox News Rundown from Washington, Kevin Cork reflects on the 9/11 anniversary from here in Washington. And if you haven't seen them yet, you soon will. Election ads. Jessica Rosenthal explores how effective they actually are. Until then, I'm Jared Halpern. Thanks for listening to the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com.